This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Giovanni Donato. We're going to be discussing neurotribalism. Giovanni, great having you back on.
Nice to be back.
Neurotribalism, it's a continuation of the overall theme you've been writing about, and we've discussed in this show about neotribalism. So basically, neurotribalism is this concept where people form groups based on personality types? Or did you coin the term, and has the topic been written about before?
I'm sure people have come up with similar ideas, given the nature of the times. But so far as I know the terms of my own coinage, I simply notice that the internet changes human social life in a fundamental way. The way people interact and the scale on which they can interact is totally different now. I mean, people have always formed groups and tribes. It's the most natural human impulse. But the internet enables that on another level, where you can take a rare trait that might be 1 in 1,000, and if you have a population of a few hundred million, there will still be plenty of them.
Yeah, it works out different ways. So sometimes it's very explicit to the whole point of people forming groups based on a personality type, and often it just evolves around similar interest, and then within different interest groups, people are going to click more with people with different personality types. So the internet is having this function of people finding their tribe is becoming the people they have the most in common with, basically not just in the United States, all over the world, and their tribe, but they're not really connected to an actual physical tribe. So the people, whether it's an extended family or a community or an ethnic group, so it's an online thing, but in your article, you predict that it will start online and then spread into a day-to-day life and continue to evolve.
Yeah, always before, the associations that human forms have been confined to a place. Historically, most people haven't gone much further from 20 miles from where they were born. Not to mention there's what is often called the Dunbar number. We humans are only capable of forming 150 or so decent quality relationships with people around us. So even within the sample size of people we can reasonably encounter face to face, there's a subset of those that we can get to know. The internet is a tool that totally remodels that situation. Or maybe we still end up with a Dunbar group, but we can refine that group out of thousands or even millions.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see how this evolves, because if you think about this in the space of the length of history, the internet's is still relatively new. So over a long period of time, it will just sort of accelerate. More and more people will connect with people they have the most common with. And it'd be interesting how the specialization of technology, like, it will be easier to find those traits. Because early on, like, you might put in, if someone's looking for something, sometimes explicitly, like, they'll do a Google search and they're interested in a meetup group for this interest. So, yeah, meetup groups are sort of, I guess they're sort of like that, but within a meetup group, there's limitations on what you can and can't say, because a lot of subcultures online anything from political to different, it could be anything online from like a political subcultures, cultural subcultures, or even like sexual fetishes. Like there's certain things that are taboo and they're purely on the internet. And I guess some people would meet up, but there's social taboos against that. But I guess meetup groups are an there's sort of an example of people meeting up around shared interest. But at the same, the thing is, because you say someone starts up a meetup group, they're limited to, there's a geographic limitation, so they're not going to be able to like hand select the people from all over the world who share their interest or they're most compatible with.
That would be a fundamental limitation of a meetup group, is it's kind of local. But I think the type of group I'm talking about, they also do things together to forge a bond of solidarity, but they have a certain type that gets winnowed out on the internet. And, you know, it's everyone's anonymous, supposedly anonymous on the internet, but I think we really aren't. Like, our thought pattern really shines through with every word we write online, and people see that. Like, have you ever seen a woman try to blend in on an MRA or Manosphere board? They always fail at it within a very short time. They just can't mimic the thought patterns.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Or a person, when people make up fake profiles, people will recognize them by their fake profile because of their writing patterns. But the thing about online is people get to be their more authentic self, and they're more uninhibited. And there's pros and cons to that. The con of that is that the negative aspect is that people engage in a lot of reckless behavior that can lead to chaos in their day-to-day life. But the positive attribute of that is people get to be their more authentic self and meet people who connect with that, because in your day-to-day life, you have to put there's a lot of social limitations on how you can express yourself. And not just like breaking taboos, but just being comfortable expressing yourself, and you can do that online, and then people have the courage to put those attributes out there, and they'll end up connecting, and that can obviously lead to great things, or it can lead to destructive behavior, depending on what that is. But anyone with like any particular traits will find a group.
Yeah, I would never say that the internet by itself is enough to create a solid group. I would think the internet is a tool that gives you a set of people you can audition face to face, so to speak. And the best of those, as far as fitting in into whatever the culture is, then you have your nucleus and you build from there.
And right now we're still in the kind of early stages of this. Different groups are forming over the internet, but it's still in the very early stages. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves. Going back to what we have in the past, is reactionaries and traditionalists, they often lament the breakdown in traditional communities or traditional identity. But the thing about that is, in the past, you were born into a family, a tribe, and you didn't get to choose that tribe. You were sort of born into that. So in some cases, it could be great, but maybe someone has a personality type or a personality preference that could clash with their group, whether it's their tribe, their community, or their family. So traditionalism, it provides some framework for being part of a cohesive group or a tribe where you have some shared bonds or traditions. But there are the problem with traditional tribalism is you are stuck in that group permanently, and basically the concept of neo-tribalism, which you've been discussing how it differs, is people get to choose their group.
You get to associate with the group where you fit best, and to some extent we don't really choose who we are. We have a raw material that we work with. So we're merely finding where we belong, I would say. And on average, we're going to belong best with people we're more closely related to. But I think neurotype is sort of a crossroads of people who are in parallel with us as far as having a similar temperament and are reasonably closely related. And you have the two, and you get a new type of tribe that is more cohesive than anything we've seen before. I mean, we were talking about the traditional tribe. Like you say, you're stuck in it, even if you're the black sheep and a misfit. Whereas now, you can sort of find the community that balances the best of all worlds. You don't fit into your family, but you can find the natural clan in your area that best fits your temperament. Probably not going to be a club of Papua New Guineans. It'll probably be a people of your larger ethnic group that are still kind of related to you, and which compensates for not fitting into your immediate family.
So yeah, there definitely is a genetic component, because traditional tribes and families were for the most part linked by genetics. So this neo-tribalism is people coming together over shared interest or the similar temperament or personality type. But I'm sure these tribes will just, people who are genetically similar are more likely to group together, even if it's not intentional. So that's will still be a major component.
Moreover, in my most recent article, I was thinking about how these groups might interact when everybody starts doing it. And I was thinking that if people are sort of assorting by the degree of agency and creativity and their overall intelligence, that some of these groups are going to be more effective than others. And I would foresee that some are going to sort of be a ruling caste.
What are some specific examples of temperaments and traits and personality types that people would connect over, like the wide variety?
Well, take for example the dissident community, as we call it. I would say a key personality trait you have to have is you got to be contrarian by nature. And I think that's a neutral quality by itself. I mean, as a virtue, it can mean you challenge undeserved authority. As an excess and a weakness, it can mean you're always signaling to be contrary without any real ideas of your own. But it is a key personality type. I think you need to be part of that community of dissidents.
Because even within a dissident sphere or a political group or subculture, people are still going to clash over temperaments and personality types. I mean, people obviously clash with their own personality type, but if you get the wrong combination of a different variance in temperament, that can lead to conflict.
I think conscientiousness is also a huge divider. Like take the conservative mentality. Those are highly conscientious people. I think the typical dissident is less conscientious than that. Though the types that are constantly signaling about racial purity and past empires and how they want to bring past empires back, I mean, I would say they're on the more conscientious end of the spectrum. And I don't feel as much affinity for that kind of signaling, because I myself am a little bit lower conscientiousness than that.
There's this issue where there's this temperament of a intellectual or of a political activist. And the thing is, I've observed the same personality types existing in rival political factions. So how do you reconcile that issue, how the same personality type exists within a different political ideologies?
I don't see that much to reconcile, to be honest. I think someone who's more inclined to be ideologically extreme could look for any number of outlets for that tendency, meaning that depending on how their life goes, they could end up on either side. And not to mention, I noticed there's a certain type of person, they go from one extreme to the other. Like if they fall out with one side, they go to the other far extreme. It's just part of who they are.
And as far as having a contrarian personality type, your political views could also be shaped by what you're challenging within a society. So your personality type in one society might be different than another, if you're of a contrarian nature.
Yeah. I mean, it really depends how your what your life experience is and which one attracts the community that of other dissidents that at the time you bond best with.
Does a tribe need a variety of traits to succeed? Because each personality trait has a positive and a strength and a weakness. And if isn't a tribe with a wide variety of those traits better able to utilize them? Well, if you say you have a tribe or group of people that has one specific personality trait that's vastly overrepresented, then could that be a disadvantage? Do you need that variety?
That's a very good one. Like I was saying, the lack of agreeableness and being contrarian can be a huge weakness, can make everyone just do the opposite without really thinking of what they're doing. And indeed, a group of people can all get together and amplify each other's defects and reinforce one another. What on the internet is often called an echo chamber. So I would think that to fit into, say, a dissident community, you have to have a basic contrarian nature, but within that spectrum, you'd also have to have complementary personality traits as well. I think it's a fine balance. And what we've seen so far looking at dissident groups is some do amplify each other's defects to the point where they finally self-destruct, and others are starting to get the balance right and really get a community started up.
What is the role of status within these neurotribes? Do you see these groups going on to be successful, or could they remain just like a bunch of tribes of outcasts, which a lot of online communities are?
I think they could go on to gain and control real resources. I mean, imagine even 20 to 30 people that actually work together in our modern society. Almost nobody does it. Almost everyone is living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to pay for a car and a mortgage. Imagine 20 to 30 people that sincerely pull resources. They'd steamroll everybody else. So a tribe of outcasts that remotely have agency and intelligence, creativity, and aren't just amplifying each other's flaws, have huge advantages.
And there's also different personality types thrive in a different environment. So what type of specific personality type would thrive under a more traditional society? What personality type would thrive in our current society, which is hyper-atomized or individualistic? And what types of temperaments or personality traits would thrive with this hypothetical neurotribalism? Well, not hypothetical, but that we're increasingly seeing and going to see where people can utilize their traits in a more collective manner.
Well, as I mentioned with conservatives, that's selects for a very highly conscientious temperament.
You would say conservatism or more hyper-individualism?
Conservatism would be more conscientious, I think, because they like religion. They like to have strict rules. It makes them feel secure. In fact, they need it to function, which is why they insist on it so heavily. And people who try to take away the rules and the structure from them, they understand on some intuitive level that is an attack on them, taking away what they need. And as far as the atomized society, I would think that's more of a neurotic kind of thing, someone who's a perfectionist and can spend every minute of their day out-competing everybody else, and that's what they thrive on.
Would you say that there are a lot of people who have the traits with potential to thrive under the right environment, but they would struggle in a more hyper-atomized society?
Look at the contrarian types who join dissident movements. A lot of them don't do that well in a conventional capitalist society. People that follow rules, are conscientious, are perfectionist, and don't have any problem with working 16 hours a day tend to do well. Unless conscientious contrarians don't really fit that mold as well, and that's part of what sends them looking for a different group to begin with.
So you divide people up on personality types primarily on conscientious versus contrarian because like there's all types of personality type theories. Like some people are really obsessed with like the Myers-Briggs test.
There's a time period where I think there's something to Myers-Briggs, but I didn't find it to be useful enough to actually find people I clicked with. So I've stopped using that terminology as much. Like I've certainly had a huge interest in the introvert aspect in the past, but as far as thinking, judging, perceiving, and all that, it's a little bit fluffy.
Yeah, it seems to be that a lot of dissident bloggers are disproportionately get INTP.
I would be in the range of INTP, INTJ if we had to talk Myers-Briggs.
And with these neurotribes, for them to actually be successful, it can't just be, as you said, like, oh, I'm going to find my Myers-Briggs types and, like, join this group, this club. For it to be truly successful, it's going to have to evolve more organically and people just connecting with the right traits rather than... Because if people just find a group for personality types and just join a club, that kind of I don't see that working. For it to succeed, it would have to be evolve over time more organically.
Yeah, so it would have to be organic, and they're going to have a common goal. And I've been involved myself in some of these emerging communities, so I can't really go into detail on that. And how I see things developing is... if you have a common goal that people are working toward beyond just like a shared interest or hobby, then you have a lot more to work with. You have a reason to pull resources and share and build infrastructure that will over time will support people and make life easier for everybody in the group.
Yeah, I mean, this is more about the economic angle, but for a tribe to succeed, they have to share resources. Part of the reason there's been this massive decline in the middle class is because of hyper-individualism and people who aren't able to utilize shared collective resources are at a massive disadvantage.
Yeah, historically, it's not normal to have a huge middle class, maybe 10 or 20% of the population at most. I mean, you could say there was sort of an algo bloom when the world wars destroyed most of the world's economies, and now history is going back to normal, where resources are kind of scarce, and you can't really have a huge middle class that easily, and
but
you have to have people on your side who will back you up, or life gets very, very difficult. I think that's a major impetus toward modern tribalism.
Well, you said that we're in a... on a previous article and show that we're in a post-scarcity economy, basically that food and services can be mass-produced. What do you mean specifically, which goods in a post-scarcity economy and what resources are scarce? Because some things can be mass-produced with automation, but then there are resources which are much more scarce. So can you specify the distinction to that?
Well, everyone can afford junk food, it seems, but that's a fairly minor expense in most people's budgets. If you look at the real expenses like rent and other positional goods, those have only been steadily going up, especially in the areas where there's actually jobs and prospective mates. And as we've discussed before, places that aren't hideous and run down. Or just depressing and sprawled out?
Yeah, that is a primary theme in my aesthetic socialism series. I'm working on some more essays on that, and we've discussed that, and I wrote my original essay. But basically, the qualities that are positional are qualities that are related to aesthetics. So that basically applies to... Because basic things, basic needs, like food can be mass-produced. And so there's a means to take care of people's basic needs, like food, shelter, and even healthcare. But the thing is, the goods that are positional are basically, they're the qualities that are more aesthetic.
I might put it this way. A carton of eggs might be $1.50, but you need to have people take you seriously so you can accumulate basic social capital to have friends and mates and your family and not be embarrassed by you. You have to have a someplace decent to live, which is expensive. You have to have a car, which isn't a complete piece of junk, which is hugely expensive. You have to have, beyond employment, you have to have the right type of employment that has the right sort of status attached to it, so people will afford you the right types of labels, so you can associate with the people you want to associate with. Part of the mistake of neoliberal thinking is that they think of the economy all the time. When people mainly participate in an economy to get the status they want.
So the components are there. That's primarily its status. It's being around the right people, which includes marriage proposals and just the people you want to associate with. So status, people, and then also the component of being able to live in a desirable area, basically real estate. So those are the three components that are positional goods. That are things that there's going to be the most competition for, as opposed to resources that are mass-produced in a post-scarcity economy.
As we go into this new tribalism, people might start to compete for people based on their capabilities or temperaments. It's sort of like Silicon Valley brain drains the whole world right now for the best talent, and might, for the rest of the country, be fine with letting in anybody.
You wrote your first article on neurotribalism, and you give the example of, say, the Silicon Valley elite, and I think this applies to a lot of economic industries and economic niches, because Silicon Valley may attract a certain personality type more, and Hollywood does. So it's not just the internet. Jobs do. Certain specific careers attract a certain personality types. And the thing is, in traditional societies, there was more diversity of occupations. So now we're seeing this trend, Silicon Valley being the best example, where one industry dominates a region. So that means one specific neurotype is going to be more like a vast overrepresented.
And I certainly found the same thing in the few years that I spent in the Washington, D.C. area. There is definitely like a certain breed of person that is attracted to that area like a magnet. Be like the student valedictorian, student government, the kid who was in all the activities, that was like the Percy, the prefect from our high school, from every high school in the country, all congregate to Washington. And it's a whole city by and for them, by the class hall monitor.
And I think for a neurotribe to succeed, they're going to have to carve out an economic niche.
Absolutely. And they will do what every tribe does, promote, hire their own. When a job offer comes open, they'll always be the first to hear of it. Just part of moving away from atomization.
Yeah, that's a big part of nepotism, because nepotism is actually the norm in most of the world, but people from Anglo or American backgrounds who are hyper-individualistic, they view nepotism as ethically wrong or discrimination, but it is part of a cohesive community as opposed to an atomized community. And another component of nepotism is the neuro, it is, there's a component of neurotribalism, because there's explicit nepotism where you say, yeah, I'll hire this guy because he's of my tribe. But the other form of nepotism is a job interviewer will choose the applicant because their personality types click. So neurotribalism, that's another component of nepotism.
Yeah, and I would say this tribal nepotism is in large part what I mean when I say smart socialism. I mean, at least it's got to be some larger tribe or polity where there is an established stake in the game or buy-in, and not just you're a citizen because you're born there. You got to do something more than that to be a shareholder. I think that's what the clear notion is in smart socialism, is you can't just be a warm body and be a shareholder.
So I guess making the distinction is egalitarian socialism, everyone gets an equal share of the pie no matter what. Under capitalism, you only get as much as you can earn in the free market. But that doesn't work because in an atomized society, a lot of people, they lack the social capital to gain the economic resources. So a smart socialist system would decide basically deciphering wealth based on either who contributes the most or who has the most potential. So it's as opposed to just leaving things up to the free market.
And like I said earlier, imagine even a dozen people that have their games together, that work together very closely. I mean, they can probably have the edge over thousands of people who are just slaving on their own.
Smart socialism, it can either be implemented by the state, or these tribes can, say there is a universal basic income, the tribes can pool their wealth and then decide they can also have their own forms of social programs within a tribe, so it can exist both simultaneously within the state, and then also services within the tribe can basically apply those same principles.
I would think basic income also has to be kind of restricted or tribal in nature, and even then done by degree based on someone's standing. Like, look at what happens with healthcare or college loans. When they can assume everyone can get a college loan, all that happens is the price of tuition increases to assume you have a college loan. Or with healthcare, they assume the price inflates to assume you have health insurance, to where the cheap loans or the health insurance aren't edges anymore. They're just barely baseline tickets to get into the game in the first place. That would be one of the hazards of any kind of universal income, is that prices would adjust if you distributed the basic income too widely.
So, hypothetically and ideally, how would you distribute the income?
You keep it within the people who you're pretty sure who, if worse comes to worse, are going to be on your side. Who are more valuable get more.
Within a state that includes multiple tribes, then obviously, just say hypothetically there's still some system of democracy, then all the tribes would still have to collaborate and say, we're going to support, like, we obviously can't, if the state favors one tribe over the other, that will lead to tension, so there could be some agreement that everyone gets the same basic income, and then each tribe can divvy up their share based on what principles they value.
Well, I can certainly tell you I've examined the possibility of, say, bringing back of the republicanism as the American founders might have envisioned it, where you only get to vote or participate in civic institutions if you have property or otherwise have a good record based on some civic standard. But from what I've seen throughout history, is any kind of republican democratic system decays very quickly because the temptation to enfranchise more people is always too great for the opposing minority party.
And kind of the whole philosophy of mass democracy, of just getting as many people to vote as possible, rather than having, you want people to be as informed as possible, but there's this obsession with getting as many people to vote as possible, regardless of how informed they are.
Right, if we look at history, the American Republic, as the founders envisioned it, barely lasted for 30 years. There was something close to universal white male enfranchisement by the 1820s to 1830s throughout the country.
You mentioned this with economic niches such as the tech industry. Do you see these neurotribes competing for members?
I would see similar brands competing where there's overlap. I mean, let's look at how all these groups of the alt-right have interacted, where it's a fairly narrow niche that they were all trying to occupy. And as we could predict, there was indeed fierce competition. But over time, I've noticed the number of brands have steadily died out, and there's just really a couple left.
Could these neurotribes eventually evolve into actual ethnic groups? I think this could happen, but it's a very long-term process.
Sure it could, and probably not as long-term as you think. Say every school hall monitor valedictorian goes to Washington and breeds exclusively there for a few generations, they're practically their own breed in a very short time.
So yeah, I think how ethnic groups evolve because, on one hand, some people just say ethnic groups are a social construct, and then some people just assume that they're kind of a set in stone. But they're an ethnic group is a group of people that are of a shared genetics, but they could evolve either between two different ethnic groups mixing together. That's one way, but another way an ethnic group could evolve as a kind of splinter. So say a very specific group who are of one ethnic group, but they share similar personality traits. Eventually they'll break off, and this will just sort of happen organically. Like over time they'll start thinking of themselves as this new ethnic group.
Yeah, my observation is it does help to be of a similar ethnic group or somewhat related. In addition to having those personality types. Like, I still find that it's very hard for, like, people of, say, totally different races to establish trust anymore. There's simply too much animosity and too large of a gap between the lives of their ancestors. So, take the dissidents, for example. A pattern that I've noticed is that they're disproportionately from the less civilized European groups outside of what's often called the Hainal or Hajnal line, where more clannish forms of marriage were practiced.
You're saying that the groups involved in the dissident sphere are disproportionately outside the Hainal line?
Yes, they're disproportionately Celtic and Slavic and Southern European, I would say. Whereas the neoliberal core, wherever you may find them, tend to be more Northern German, Scandinavian, like true Anglo-English, Low Countries. You get the idea. The core Western Europe.
I'm not sure if I've noticed that. I think there's like a pretty good number of Anglos in the dissident sphere.
That's why I use the word disproportionate. Though even if you look at the Anglo element, I'm sure you'll find a lot more of them are of the Cavalier element that went to the south than of the Puritan or Midlander element that went to the north and mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, I think there's this blogger, was it J-Man, who's written about this. He writes for Owens about the very specific groups from the British Isles who colonize different parts of the United States, whether it's the Puritans or the Cavaliers, because that is totally an example of a neurotribalism, because even in the past, certain traits were more common even in more specific regions. So that's probably part of the reason you see like regional tensions within nations. Even in the United States, I mean, in Europe or Asia, you've had people living in the same regions for centuries. But that even tends to happen in the United States. Like, someone from the South has a different personality type than someone from New York, or someone from the upper Midwest or Pacific Northwest or California. And also different parts of the United States would appeal to different people from other parts of the world or people from the East Coast when they move to the West Coast or Midwest. So neurotribes tend to form on geographical lines.
Yes, J-Man was basing his analysis on a book called Albion's Seed, and the HBD chick was also writing a lot about this. And the basic premise was that the Cavaliers went to the south, the Puritans and East Anglia people, they went to like the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the north, and then Quakers and so on went to Pennsylvania and kind of the center. You get the idea. And a concept that's kind of growing from the dissident sphere is that the American Civil War was even sort of an outgrowth of the English Civil War, where the Cavaliers and the Puritans fought again on another continent because they came from the similar opposing bloodlines.
Geography plays a role, so on one hand, neurotribe may be synonymous with a specific geographic region, but you also make this point about modern tribalism is in its current form or as it's evolving does not align with a nation state or piece of land. So the tribe is the members. So the members are the tribe, and that could apply to basically anything from economic elites to online subcultures.
Yeah. Or you may also look at the Scotch-Irish. I mean, they started as people living on the border with England and Scotland, sort of living into an independent clannish lifestyle in this area that was usually war-torn. And then they got moved to Northern Ireland, where they continued to forge territory for themselves in a hostile area. Then they got moved to the New World, where they did the same thing with the Native Americans, where they were colonists pushing their way in against the locals. They kept the same identity no matter where they went. Clearly it was a part of who they were as a people.
I touched on this theme with status, but how much of a role will class play? Will these neurotribes be from one specific class, or will there be a diversity of classes within the neurotribe?
To some extent, the classes already are tribal. And I think one of the way neurotribalism is even different from this is it's sort of like beer compared to whiskey. Like the neurotribals allows for an ultra-distilled version. Since take the Swipple upper middle class, the yuppies, they have a very tribal feel and element about them. And this is exactly what the red tribe, these conservatives, mean when they say those liberals. They're talking about people of a different tribe with different allegiances and different totems.
Because, yeah, classes become tribes because even though if they're from the same nationality or ethnic group, they become so distant culturally and sociologically. And if they isolate themselves so much over time, then basically they become almost like a whole another nationality.
And they already are. And I write about this, that because of this phenomenon, the nation state, which was the animating institution in the 19th and 20th centuries, is basically defunct. And we can tell it's defunct because within the same supposed nation, we see drastically different cultures, drastically different policies from one area to another. You don't see in practice a single nation anymore, in the sense of the monolithic 20th century. In the 20th century where you could mobilize an army of 20 million men and land them on another continent and everyone would be on the same page. You just can't do that anymore.
And there's this idea of pan-secessionism, of carving up the nation into a bunch of smaller nations. But I really don't see that happening because all these different groups of people, they're so interconnected and so many places are so diverse. So the United States will, I mean, it's hard to say. I think it will probably exist as a geographic and political entity. But as far as identity goes, there'll be these tribes, but it won't be solid geographic territory. So there won't be a specific state. So within one state, you'll have multiple tribes and they become like a country within a country. That's basically already happening.
I think secession is the wrong word. Secession is almost only a meaningful word if you're talking about the old-fashioned nation-state. It'll be more like the, as you say, the nation sort of persists on paper as a hollow shell, while the tribes all do their thing.
And since you were discussing the alt-right sphere, it seems to be their mentality is kind of all or nothing. Like, either they want, there's a kind of a more Trump supporters, American nationalists who want to retake America. There's the kind of Richard Spencer types talking about carving out their own nation in the Pacific Northwest. And then there's the people who are totally black-pilled, and they say that everything, that basically we're all doomed. And the first two are unrealistic, and the latter is unnecessary. Basically, what the future will be is people won't, we're not going to have like a cohesive society on a large scale. But I don't think people should be totally pessimistic, because I think neo-tribalism could potentially lead to chaos, but it could provide something positive for people. So what we have now is this, basically this atomized society, and tradition is not going to be restored. The future trend will be neo-tribalism, but I think it's important to emphasize positive aspects, because this could actually end up being one of the very first times in history where people can choose the type of society they want to live in, and to not just different tribes, being able to choose the type of society you live in, as opposed to just one mass society. The way a society works is people make compromises, and then everyone has to give up a little. Basically, societies based on tribes, people will be able to, it will be more specific to their personal taste and interest, and it kind of reminds me of what Brandon Adamson has always said, that true freedom is not being able to do what you want in a libertarian sense, but being able to live in the type of society that you want to.
Yeah, there's not much freedom when you have the, say, a global system of culture and finance where everyone wears suits across the entire globe.
So with neo-tribalism, be a more decentralized elite?
Yes. If anything, the Silicon Valley elite, as we can see in their neglectfulness, where they're pale, they're walled in green zone, and they don't really care about anywhere outside. I would think a responsible elite is not that decentralized, but they also aren't as hands-on. They aren't enforcing strict rule everywhere. They might have the other places as vassal states and make sure people have a reasonable standard of living, but they prefer a lighter hand to a heavier one.
And also, it would provide more economic opportunities, because if you have like multiple smaller elites, then more people can join those than everyone competing to join basically one elite within a greater society.
I would think a successful long-term neuro-neo elite would have this insight, that they have to scout around for people who are like them, which is the impulse that formed neuro-tribes to begin with. Because say you're in that top tribe and you only have these very strict gates of entry, you'll filter some people like you out, and they will be weapons lying around for other people to use against you.
In a neuro tribe, how would that, you discussed this with conscientiousness, but how would this affect people's religious and moral outlooks?
I think that would depend on the neuro tribe. The group religion or group conventions would take the form of the people itself. Like a highly contrarian group, for example, that's not as conscientious would have a less structured religion, where, you know, a highly conscientious group of average or below average intelligence is going to have strict rules.
And also different religions and churches appeal to different temperaments and personality type. So someone who goes to a Episcopal church is very different than someone who goes to a Southern Baptist church. So you could also make the case that religions, subsets of religions and the major religions are also function as neurotribes.
Yes, so I think one of the things that has developed in the dissident community is the concept of a religion has expanded. It's sort of understood as the group mythology, the group rules on a larger level, not just like a holy book or a god. So this is what they mean when when we talk about secularism as the modernistic religion.
People's personality traits also affect people's taste in aesthetics. As far as neurotribes, how will that impact aesthetic taste in architecture, art, and music?
I think very greatly. The personality of each group will come across very keenly in its architecture. And it, actually, aesthetics are a lot of how these groups filter for people in the first place. People, even as little kids, will be attracted to things they think simply look or sound or seem cool.
And people move to different areas with a unique aesthetic. Their temperament impacts that. So some people prefer a much more dense and urban environment. Some people prefer a tranquil environment. And there's also people who value aesthetics more. So some people are willing to pay a premium to live in a place with higher aesthetic attributes. And that's a very specific temperament, someone who places a strong value on aesthetics. And then there's some people who are purely utilitarian. They want to find maybe the biggest house they can find for the best bargain and don't care so much about aesthetics. So places with different aesthetic standards are going to attract different personality types.
Yes,
and the same could be said about environmentalism. People interested in environmentalism or just nature in general, that's also a neurological trait.
And like we were even saying about regular people just trying to fit into society, they do have to meet a certain aesthetic to do that, which is why those goods are so highly positional.
And people are increasingly moving around, so traditional tribalism, people were stuck in the same area basically their whole lives, and you have generations and generations there. If a specific geographic location will be associated with certain interest, people will move there, and you'll see geographic interests become more specialized. Because it's kind of interesting, because traditionally we've had these regional cultures in America, like New England, the South, the Southwest. And gradually over time, because there is this period where we're seeing this massive trend in cultural homogenization, but I think that's actually temporary. I do think in the future that neo-tribalism could actually lead to a return in these more stronger, distinct regional cultures.
It could, but I think one of the things that makes the new neurotribalism distinct and unique is that it's about the people wherever they may be, and it's not tied to land like pretty much every traditional culture is. Like, you look at the lore of Native Americans or the Norse, it doesn't matter who, and the land itself is almost like a godly presence. It's very special to them. Whereas I feel like a neurotribe could set up anywhere and make it their own. The nature of modern life is semi-nomadic. It's an inevitable byproduct of having airplanes and cars that can take you anywhere very quickly.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Giovanni, is there anything else you'd like to add about neurotribalism?
I think it'll be interesting to see the hierarchies develop, and in my own experiences from the inside watching these organizations take shape, taking inspiration from ones that already exist, like the barons of Silicon Valley, let's even mention the Jews. I think they have already shown what a powerful tribe can do, but as neurotribes develop, there'll be a traditional tribe of 115 IQ competing with highly focused tribes of 130 or more that are hyper-concentrated.
I also think people, this ties in with class, but people will increasingly segregate on IQ differences.
Because assortative mating will become even more important than it is now. No one will want kids that aren't like them and can't fit into their increasingly specific niche. And just another impetus for the forming of new ethnicities and new groups and new peoples. The 19th to 20th century was a mass extinction of languages and ethnic groups. Even the centuries before that in Europe and elsewhere saw the evaporation of hundreds of languages and dialects into standardized languages that we know now. For example, even if you went to England or Italy, I mean, until everyone had to go to school and it was standardized in books, you would have a different dialect in every valley. And it was pretty much like that all over the world. Ironically, the pendulum may be going back the other way, and we may be entering an age of fracture.
So yeah, basically the cultural homogenization that we've been seeing, it's basically a temporary trait. So these new cultures, which will, in some ways, will be kind of be started by scratch. So they could be influenced by both tradition and who knows, maybe attributes of pop culture and modern culture. So they'll be kind of borrowing from modern culture, but then taking that and then creating something, I guess I wouldn't say traditional, but at least building something out of that.
Yeah, some of the changes here are never before seen in history, but it's an amplification of what's come before, kind of like the printing press sort of made the Enlightenment and the neoliberal order and all those revolutions possible. The spread of more information.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Giovanni Donato for being on. It's been an excellent show.
All right, thank you.